The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on October 18, 2020. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Well, good morning, everybody. Good to see you. This morning I thought, once again, haven't done this now a few times since I've been here now, but I thought I would like to just see if you have any questions, anything you'd like to discuss in regards to our teaching or the practice. So I'll leave it to you this morning. Jeff.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, Jeff.
My question is about symmetry, which you've talked about several times, so I'm not really clear on what that is in physics, and I'm not real clear on how that relates to the two truths.
Oh, yes, okay. Well, symmetry, normally when we think of symmetry, we're thinking of like bilateral symmetry or rotational symmetry, something like that, which is fine. And this still relates to how a physicist might look at symmetry. But in that case, they're talking about any kind of system where the overall and a change can occur within the system, but the overall picture reveals that there's something here that doesn't change. Something remains the same. And that even applies to something like rotational symmetry. If you take a square and you just rotate it 90 degrees, it's back to looking as it did before you rotated it. And so that's just one example of it. But the way physicists are looking at it is that in nature, you have something that's occurring within a system that continues to exhibit change, and yet there's something else. The overall picture of it doesn't really change, or it keeps coming back to the same point, or something of that sort. And how this relates to the two truths is just simply, and I'm giving this in very simple terms. Again, the book that I've just recently come out now that I've done, I get into this a little more detail. But the way this relates to the two truths, which is a basic Buddhist teaching, certainly we find it with Nagarjuna, and that is that we have this one aspect of this reality that we're living out that is continuous change, constantly changing. And this is a relative truth. This is a truth of the samsaric world of birth and death, coming and going, endless change. And in fact, looking at it from this standpoint, we don't find anything that doesn't change. If there's anything appearing, anything whatsoever, a thought, a feeling, not to mention, you know, an object or a physical object or something like that, but anything that that appears in this world, any impression of any sort, any mental, you know, object, mind object, it will exhibit change. Nothing is holding still, and that's one truth. That's relative truth or small t truth. Then that's available to conception. That's our conceptual experience, this continuous change. Most of us are completely locked into that. We also have our perceptual experience, but we don't pay any attention to that generally. And one of the reasons is because it's always thus. This doesn't change at all. But we tend to tune that out. And this isn't something mysterious either. Your attention can be drawn to it, such as, for example, we can talk about, when we talk about change, we're also talking about time and movement and things of this sort. And so when we talk about time, now we can talk about past and future. None of this is strange or mysterious to us. And yet, we don't realize how much this is just mental construction. What's actually taking place here, of course, it's always now. And this doesn't change. It is always now. We often equate now with the present moment. You know, we talk about past, present, and future in that world of change, that the conceptual, the small t truth world, the world of coming and going, the samsaric world. We'll talk about past, present, and future, and then we might substitute now for the present moment. But that's not quite right, because it's always now. And that present moment, which is an identifiable point, that suddenly now this seems to be past and slipping away from us. That's how we tend to look at it. You can look at it in other ways as well. But that's an example of the two truths in kind of an everyday way in which it might show up for us. Again, we tend not to give too much attention to the fact that it's always now. It's always thus. It's always here. And when our attention is drawn to it, we also might tend to think, well, so what? You know, of course, naturally, whatever. But this is the vibrant reality. It's here now. And that we're actually living out. We don't live in the past. We don't live in the future. These are all mind constructs. And yet, and virtually everything else in this small t truth world is just that. It's mental construction of all sorts. And this is where we remain caught. This is, for us, this is reality. This is really true, real. I am here, and there's objects in front of me. I'm talking to people. You know. And this is true enough. We give it a small t. It's not like it's that it's dismissible or something like that. But the true nature of what is taking place here, that we can identify and talk about objects and me and all of that out there, and on we go. For most of us, that's it. I mean, this is reality. But what the awakened to is actually the full range of what is being experienced here is being ignored totally. In that it is always thus, it's always here, it's always now, and we give no attention to this. And this would be truth with a capital T. So here we have these two truths. And just as in symmetry, and by the way, about symmetry, that's become a very important thing now in science, and in particular physics, but elsewhere as well. But they've come to realize that the deep underlying nature of physical reality is such that these two, they don't call it the two truths, but these two aspects of this, one of continuous change, and yet there's this other aspect where things are not changing. If this pattern doesn't show up, say, in their mathematical descriptions of whatever it is they might be hypothesizing or theorizing about, they now know that they're out of step with reality, that this pattern has to be there in their calculations and in their thinking. They now realize that this symmetry is a deep underlying principle of nature, and they cannot ignore it. But it has, this aspect that there's some aspect of this that's nothing but change, continuous change, another aspect of it where it doesn't seem that there's anything changing at all. And this, in Buddhist thinking, if we get into this, particularly with Nagarjuna, we get into this fairly deeply and begin to realize what he's pointing at, often like when he's talking about emptiness or something of this sort, we have these two truths at work here. But a simple way to look at it, one is there's this dynamic changing, everything is impermanent, you know, there's nothing but change. Then as Nagarjuna points out, but you get to the depth of understanding impermanence and you realize there is nothing impermanent. It is always thus. It is always now. So anyway, I don't know, does that help you, Jeff? But that kind of lightly just touches on what symmetry is and how that relates to the two truths. I hope that helps a bit. It's in my book, too. If you read my book, I hope I spell it out maybe a little bit more clearly there than I did here now, with other examples as well. So, okay, well, anything else then? Cindy.
So to follow up on this Jeff's question and your response, when you say thus, is that, and this is the wrong way to ask this, I'm sure, but is that referring to...
No, there's no way, wrong way to ask.
Is that referring to the changing aspect of symmetry, or is that referring to this ongoing, this that doesn't change?
Well, symmetry is just a way of pointing to or talking about or working with what's appearing here.
Yeah. Whatever word you
And likewise, the two truths as well.
The two, right.
Yeah. But thus is just simply, the problem is we can't even really talk about what's going on exactly. We can kind of point to it with our words, and that's sort of what we're doing here, and then using terms like the two truths or symmetry or something like this. These are ways of pointing to what's going on. But thus is just simply, here it is, thus. This isn't nothing. That's another way that I hope it's helpful to realize, obviously, and this is just obvious, obviously this isn't nothing. Something seems to be taking place here. Of course, it actually isn't really something. If it were something, we could get hold of it, but we can't. That would be the conceptual again. We can get hold of it conceptually, whether it's a physical thing or a thought or a feeling, we can, but that isn't it. That isn't totality. And when we do get hold of things, now we're ignoring this overarching reality of thus, here it is, you know, it's just this. So this is just a way of pointing. The conceptual will try to get a grip on it, but you can't get a grip on it. However, you can see that. You can realize, we can wake up to this. The nature of what is taking place here is ungraspable. You can't get hold of it, but we can see it. One of the things, you know, Robert Thurman, and I forget, I think it might have been in his book on Vimalakirti. I forget now where this is, but anyway, but he used a phrase somewhere, which I really liked, and I used it for a while, and that was that he said the bodhisattva learns to tolerate inconceivability. And I thought, wow, yeah, when I came upon that, that's a very good way of putting this. But now I've come to realize, and it is, but I think maybe it's even gets us a little closer to the issue of what's being pointed out here, that we can learn to not tolerate. It isn't a matter of tolerating. With awakening, it isn't that we put up now with reality. We can tolerate this ungraspable nature of life. It isn't that at all. We become at ease with it. We become at home with it. We're not fighting with it. And we're no longer desperately trying to get hold of it. Because at some point, we get a thorough going taste of the fact that this is totally ungraspable. That is its nature. Its wonderful, vibrant nature is that we can't grasp it. There's some aspect of this that we could grasp. Suddenly, everything becomes dead. As things sort of appear to be in many ways within our experience, like, you know, and now we're confined in all sorts of ways. There's mystery, we don't know what's going on. We conceive ourselves as something persisting and yet changing, and then we worry about, well, what's in my future and what happens when I die. These kinds of things start creeping into, well, they're just there in our mind as a result of all of this. But all of this is coming from the fact that our perceptual experience is always ongoing, and that's what I'm talking about here. But we don't pay attention to it. We don't know how to read it or something like that, recognize it for what it is. But it is ungraspable, and at some point when we actually see that and realize that this is the nature of reality, we can then become at ease with this. It's not a matter of tolerating it. Tolerating it still belies the fact that we're thinking that, well, you know, we just can't get a grip on this, so we just kind of learn to tolerate it. It's not really yet seeing that actually this is how it is, and we don't have to tolerate. All we have to do is wake up to the nature of what is actually taking place here. It is mind only, and with that, you can't get hold of it in any way. And this isn't really so strange. How do you get hold of a taste, or a sound, or a feeling? You know, we could even explore this in a matter of how do we get a hold of an object, even a physical object. There's problems that creep in there. I touch on some of that in my book. I won't try to drag it out now because it's a little bit more subtle. But anything that we're experiencing in this way, we can't get hold. How do you get hold of an idea? Where's the edges of it? How did it form? Where did it come from? None of this stuff. And did I change it? Did I come with this idea? Or did I get it from... We can't get hold of any of these things. But most of the time, we just kind of go along and, well, this is that, and this is this, and this works with that, and this way. But then when we do pause, if we're really honest with ourselves, we realize, well, this is all rather mysterious here. You know, what's going on? Where do we get here? Of course, we can make up beliefs, graspable beliefs. Well, some deity made this, or, you know, there's nothing to it. It's just when you die, that's it, you know. We'll come up with all kinds of ways of dealing with that. But all of those things are beliefs. They're still mental construction, all of that. Awakening is nothing like that at all. You don't end up with a picture of how it is or an explanation of how it is. We directly see how it is. And this seeing is our perceptual experience. And I'm talking about seeing italicized here now. If I were writing this out, I would be italicizing this seeing, because I'm not talking about seeing objects or seeing things or concepts or anything of that sort. It's just a direct realization of the nature of what is actually unfolding here. And with that, we can also see that there's nothing to grasp about this. And yet here it is in all its splendid array as it reveals itself to us, moment by moment, full of feeling and thought and taste and flavor or color and whatever, and as well as touch and all of this. And did I say thought? Any emotion? All of this. And it's just this wonderful sort of thing. But if we don't really see the nature of it, we're pulled by this and frightened by that and tugged by this. And it's very difficult, you know. But it is possible. This is what awakening is. It's just suddenly we can see the nature of this. And it's just the nature of thus. I believe that's what you asked about. Just what do you mean by that? Well, it's just, this isn't nothing. Just thus. And you want to know what that is? Yeah. But again, if I were to make that into an object that you can grasp, well, of course, now we're back to ordinary thinking. And it's just ordinary believing. I mean, you're still confused. So even if I could put something there, I wouldn't. But fortunately, I can't. So nobody can. Buddhists can't. But we don't need to. They don't need to. This is what we wake up to. This is akin to Yaka-san sitting there and his teacher, when he asks him, well, what is it that you're not doing? And even Buddhists don't know. And that's something that could seem like maybe a funny little passage that we can ignore, but actually that's a pretty profound pointing there, something we can pay attention to. Buddhas don't know in the sense of they don't have a conceptual grip on this at all. Well, they might have a conceptual grip on this or that, as we all might with a human mind, all of that, but they see that for what it is. As for reality, there's nothing to grip. But we can see that, and we can understand its nature in such a way that we feel no need to grip. And it isn't a matter of putting up with anything. It isn't a matter of tolerating it. It doesn't feel that way at all once it's directly seen. So I don't know, did that help you, Cindy?
Yeah, I think I've asked this question before in a different form.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is, you're not the only one, believe me. Yeah, there's many ways to come at this, and the subtlety with which all the ways in which all the different things are showing up within our experience, it's easy to recast it in various kinds of questions. Yeah. You know.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Yes, Steve. Yeah. We have a number of questions in the chat room.
Oh, okay.
So I'll just read to you the first one here.
Sure.
This is from Ed, and Ed asks, "How do you pick which beliefs to pursue?"
Oh, I don't. That's the short answer. I don't hold beliefs, so that doesn't even really mean too much to me. But let's see if I can say something helpful here. So I don't choose which beliefs to pursue, but what I want to look for, let's put it this way. What I don't want to lose track of is wholeness. Totality, and as different fragmented ideas or thoughts or beliefs, whatever concepts that we might come up with, that I might want to work out of or something, or at least to kind of, if I can, relate to how someone else might be using it and are asking questions about it. But I don't want to lose sight of totality, where I will pursue some point, some answer, some graspable thing of some sort and start running with it or handing that to others and things like that. That's why this teaching, too, I found this with my teacher, Katagiri Roshi. I found it certainly with Nagarjuna, Wangpo, all these guys. When I first approached them, I was like, what are they talking about? At least in the case of Katagiri Roshi, I had a living person there that I could confront. But and then he'd say something, and I kind of walk away like, oh, okay, yeah, he just said something there, and I'm walking away, and 5 minutes later, like, what though? What, you know? Just like he didn't really hand me anything, in a sense, except he was pointing out something. So, and I don't want to lose sight of this, you know. So it isn't a matter of getting the right idea, and now I'm going to pursue this, or I'm going to pursue. And that's another problem too. When you lose sight of totality, wholeness. If you latch on to this one, you pursue this one, now you're abandoning these others, or maybe at least not giving your full attention to them. And there might be something very important and highly valuable that's in those things. And the other thing, too, that we'll do with belief is that pretty soon we start to identify with it. And the next thing you know, now we're going to be fighting and arguing with people that happen to go a different way. And that's not helpful either. So belief, and in the book I just finished, belief gets kind of the short end of the stick, I guess. I don't know. There's major problems with belief, and belief actually acts as an obstacle to truth. If you really want to wake up to reality, to truth, don't worry too much about what you believe. I say I don't hold beliefs. That means I don't subscribe to them. I don't identify with them. I won't march around thinking, well, this is really true, because I realize it's a constructed thing, and as a constructed thing, keeping totality inside, I can see that, you know, this isn't ultimately true. And it starts to become quite obvious what's not ultimately true about it, and the kind of painful and difficult circumstances that can present for us. On the other hand, with any particular, I wouldn't call it a belief. A belief is only when you grasp it, thinking that it's true. That's what makes it a belief. Otherwise, it's just a formed thought of some kind, a concept or whatever. And these can be very handy and very useful at times. But again, if you keep wholeness in mind and look at how this might function in the world as a whole, try not to lose sight of that. But if you don't identify with it or grasp it or think, but this is the truth, it won't be so difficult for you to let these things go when the time comes for you to let them go. So that's also kind of helpful there. So Ed, I don't know if that helped you at all. If I thought about it longer, I might come up with a few more things. But again, this is something I talk about in the first part of the book that I just did. It's come out now, but belief. I keep showing up there. I don't really look at it directly so much in the first part, but in the second part, I start turning our attention to it, because it's really a major factor, and it's sort of the bane of human existence, belief. Sorry, but we can live like Sextus Empiricus, the ancient Greek who said, I'll confuse him with Suzuki Roshi, who said, I've come to realize that you have to believe in nothing. But Sextus Empiricus, he said that it is enough to live by experience and without subscribing to beliefs. And I think he was quite wise in that. I remember when I first came upon that, I was still a pretty young guy, and I was intrigued by what he said. I couldn't quite see what he's getting at, though. It seemed kind of strange, you know. But I've come to realize now how profound and wise that observation is. It's enough to live by experience, direct experience, perceptual experience, not conceptual. So like, we can let that go. You can slide around, might be helpful in various ways, but don't hang on to it. Just live out of the perceptual, the direct experience of reality, without subscribing to beliefs, without taking hold of this or that, or thinking this is true and this is better than that, and all those sorts of things. So, Ed, I hope that helped you there. Is there another one, Steve?
Yeah, there are two more questions. This one's from Doug. And Doug asked, can you suggest a helpful response to the proposition that consciousness takes place in the brain?
Well, story that I've often used, that for me it was pretty powerful when I witnessed it. I used to live near Lake Calhoun. It's now Lake Bede Matiska. They changed the name, and maybe rightly so. That was the original name of the lake with the Native Americans here. And I used to live over there. Now I live near Lake Harriet. But in those days, when I saw this, it was over there at the Lake Bede Matiska. And along one part of the lake there's a sort of a brushy hillside. And then it comes down to a level, and there's a bike path, and then more grass, and then the walking path, and then a little more grass, and then the lake. And so it was kind of a broad expanse, and I remember coming along there. It wasn't not uncommon to see a huge flock of Canadian geese. And I remember it was just common enough sight. But this one particular day, I'm walking along, and the flock of geese was from the hillside, the bushes to the hillside, and all over to the lake. So I was going to have to walk through this crowd of geese. It covered the path totally, no space at all. And then I saw an elderly lady approaching me with a little tiny dog on a leash. And the dog was probably about the size of a cat, maybe slightly larger perhaps, I don't know. But it was a very small dog on a leash. And as she was approaching the flock of geese from the other side, all of a sudden the heads were going up, the geese honk, honk, they were honking and stuff. And pretty soon the geese were all parting from the path. It was like, I don't know, Moses parting the waters or something. The geese just went to either side. And the lady came through with her dog. And I went through as well. Well, the next day, the very next day, I think it was, same situation. I was in the same general area there. And again, flock of geese covering the path, everything. And then coming down out of the hillside there where the bushes were, came a cat. And the cat started approaching, got into some grassy area there, but then it was approaching the flock of geese. And I thought, well, this will be interesting, after what I'd just seen the day before. And so here comes the cat, and I was expecting, are the geese now going to part? Well, they didn't. They didn't raise their heads. They didn't honk. They just sit there kind of eating the grass is what they do. And they didn't change their behavior one bit. And the cat started wandering in among the flock and didn't change. The geese just kept on acting as they always did. Had no bearing on that. That just shows to me that consciousness, here we try to look for consciousness like in the brain and that it must be doing something or whatever, and yet we can't seem to be able to, with all our massive computers now and all of this, we don't seem to be able to come up with anything like the consciousness that you or I have, or even a bird. The geese, there's a large bird, but the bird's brain can't be much bigger than a walnut. And yet, in an instant, these birds could see the difference between a dog and a cat. And again, the dog and the cat were of comparable size. It was a large cat, it was a small dog. They were of comparable sizes, actually. And yet, in an instant, these birds with their little bird brains were instantly behaving in a different way. They recognize this difference immediately. And yet, with all of our computing power back then, that was back in the 80s when I witnessed it, I wrote about it in my first book, and there the computing power at the present day, the supercomputers we had could calculate about 10 billion calculations per second. Today, I don't know what it is, but it's got to be in the trillions or even more, supercomputer, way beyond what we had back in the 1980s. And yet they're still struggling with this. They're finally starting to come up with different techniques that what might help a computer distinguish the difference between a dog and a cat. So if we think that consciousness is produced by the brain and by a machine, by some physical construction or something of this sort, how are you going to explain this? That the fact that we keep thinking, well, if we could put together the right materials, and maybe we can make we can certainly make machines appear to be intelligent, but of course we're programming all that intelligence into them, so to speak. But computers will continue to make stupid mistakes that any one of us would identify in an instant. And after 30, 40, 50 years of this kind of research and whatever, they're still trying to come up with a way to construct an intelligent and a conscious machine. Well, from what I understand of consciousness, that just isn't going to happen, because in waking up to those two truths of what I was talking about before, when we wake up to the perceptual experience, you will realize that this is of the whole, of totality, and that consciousness or mind is built into the very fabric of reality itself. It isn't something constructed. Consciousness isn't created. It isn't made. And there aren't things like people or animals that actually possess something like this, something else altogether. And if we didn't lose sight of wholeness, if were we to really see how wholeness is involved in this picture, and it has nothing to do with locality or where you are, where things are, because this is all highly questionable anyway, that there is something. These are all appearances. This is all mental construct. Locality and place and time and even like where consciousness is located, as if that made sense. It hasn't any locality. And there's many, many other things I could say about this. It's like when, your mental experience. Where's that located? You can't locate that. You smell a rose, you know, but the rose is across the room in a vase or something. But here, you're here and you're smelling it. Well, where's this smelling taking place? And of course, we'll point to our head as if, you know, it's up here in my brain, as if that made any sense. But this is where we are. The thing is, we lock onto these beliefs. And we model the whole universe after these ideas that we have based on these. But just like right after Newton's time, when the latest gadgetry of the day was they had finally learned to build clocks, you know, clockworks and things of this nature. And so that was the latest technology. And so we started describing the universe as the clockwork universe. Yeah? And it's all based on something like a clockwork. And now with our latest gadgetry is the computer, and so we're trying to make it all fit into that box. And yet if we just simply look at a few things, and I bring out some of this again in my book, different ways of looking at this, including that dog story, but it's hard to make a case. In fact, I think it fails totally. Cartesian dualism fails, but it doesn't fail for the reason that philosophers and physicists or scientists think, because the world is fundamentally material. It fails because the world is fundamentally mind. And I think I make a strong case for that in the book. But anyway, that's what I would say. I hope I answered the question. I think I kind of lost track of exactly what the question was now, but...
Yeah, Steve, thank you. I think, you know, your story of the geese and the dogs is very helpful. So we have two more questions in chat, and then somebody's just raised their hand. So we have about three questions.
Okay.
So first we'll get to Shannon's question in the chat room. She asks, can meditation practice be successful amidst chaos? Is my practice hindered by an inability to always find quietude?
Well, stop insisting on quietude. We're always in the middle of chaos anyway, but chaos doesn't necessarily mean that it's noisy and distracting. It could be also very, very peaceful and calm. It's important for your mind to calm down that you don't keep insisting on creating a particular kind of atmosphere or a place for that. In Dogen's Fukan Zazengi, you know, he says a quiet room is suitable. He doesn't say it's imperative. He doesn't, you know, he's not insisting that you, but it's suitable. But if you can't find this quiet room, there's a lot of construction going on next to where you live or something like that, and big machines, digging and pounding away and whatever. Well, maybe you can't find that quiet place, but still. You don't have to go searching for that quiet place, and now I can sit down and let my mind get quiet. Of course, that's helpful. That's very helpful for that. It's suitable to that. But gradually, what we can find is that quiet, that stability, that settledness in our mind, and just in your mind itself. And you can learn to sit down right where you are, no matter what the circumstances might be around you. But this is just a matter of of time, and it's a matter of just continuing to practice, but to gradually notice that at some point, if you are having some kind of expectations or demands in your mind that it must be a quiet place or something, or I can't do this, just see if you can sit with that. Do what you can to make it quieter and more settled. Certainly we set up the Zendo here at the center in that way. It's a settled place generally. But I remember one morning at our second period of meditation in the morning, here some massive trucks came down the street and around the corner there, and they started tearing down. Before we were done with our meditation, they were already beginning to tear down the house across the street. And and so what can we do? But we just continue to sit there. Gradually we can learn to do that. The quietness and the settledness, the shi of shikantaza, is within your own mind, and you can find that in time. But one of the more helpful ways is just simply to not insist that it must be something other than what it is right now. Again, take modest steps to help that a bit, but don't insist on it, and you more quickly will find a settled mind in whatever circumstance. I hope that helped. Shannon, was it? I hope that helped you, Shannon.
All right. The next question in our chat room is from Jose, and he asks, is there a role for the Buddha Dharma in saving the planet from the dire consequences of climate change ahead?
Well, to put it that way, a role, as if there was something kind of written for this way of practice to play here. It is just simply, I would say, yes, just go ahead with and practice the Buddha Dharma, the Buddha way, the Buddha's teaching, Buddha's practice, and this in doing this gradually, as we begin to wake up to our surroundings and the world around and the nature of what this is taking place here, certainly this fits into it. To the extent that we can live this way, live out of a profound and quiet and deep understanding of reality, we wouldn't get ourselves into these situations in the first place. But of course, the way things are now, we want to get out there and straighten things up very quickly, because the situation we're in is so dire. But we need to just be very careful there. The idea that we would use our meditation or this practice as some kind of instrument that we would apply to the world and the circumstances in the world, that's not really the way to see this. Or even to apply to you in your own mind, that I have to settle myself. Now, just stop looking at it in those terms. Just take this up and do this and live out of this without a lot of ideas about how this might help the world or others or whatever. You can see that it does, in the sense that it's one way in which we can not just point to, but actually live out of a settledness and a quietness. And certainly we can point these kinds of things out to others and that sort of thing, just as I'm doing right now, as a matter of fact. But the idea that we will use this specifically to bring about these ends, that's our ordinary view again. That's our ordinary understanding. There's intention in it. There's and difficulty with it. There's going to be obstruction that confronts that, and any number of things. So I don't know, Jose, if I answered you there. I hope I understood your question.
All right, and then we have a couple of people who have questions in the regular queue here.
Sure. Okay.
Yassine, you go ahead and unmute yourself.
Oh, hello, hello. Hope you can hear me well.
Yes.
Excellent. I just had a question on the Dogen's Genjo Koan.
Uh-huh.
It's about there is the firewood and the ash, and
yes,
there is the winter and the spring, right? And
yeah.
I had some difficulties with this notion of continuity. So let's say we're in the middle of winter, right? And then one day is a warm day, right?
Yeah.
And then we have imputed a concept of winter on what is, but in fact this day is not what we would call winter or something.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a spring-like day in the middle of winter. Yeah.
For example, yeah. And then the other question was on the continuity of this firewood. And so with the two truths, there is like both, like there is both like a past as like just like, just like a log, and like the future just as an ash, in our like conventional like truths. But in this moment, there is only like firewood, and even firewood itself, like every moment is the entire universe being this firewood, or contributing to this being the firewood, so nothing in particular.
Yeah.
But there is a difference between the continuity of the firewood, like from one moment to the next, like until it's ash, and this winter thing. So maybe it's just that this just means that our imputing of like concepts is just like it's just a little bit closer for our firewood than it is for winter. It's just like just a conceptualization or something. So yeah. So I let you.
Yeah, well, it's really the same thing going on in both cases. Winter, you know, like Dogen says that we don't say that winter becomes spring, you know, something like that, because winter is winter, and spring is spring. But and the firewood is firewood, ash is ash. We think, yeah, well, firewood becomes ash. You know, we burn it and then it becomes ash. We burn it. And of course, we think that word "it" refers to something. Well, what does it refer to? Firewood? Well, when it's fire, before we start burning, and then, but now it's burning. It is burning. Well, what does it refer to? Now it is at. What is it? And this is our concern. And same thing with winter, spring. Same sort of thing. Well, it is now. What is now winter? It's winter. And also we have a warm day, and this seems like spring, and the snow is melting, all this sort of thing, and the next day is back to freezing again, you know. But it's winter, and the sun is so low and all that. But we see this is the conceptual. We conceptualize like winter. We identify, we label it, we even put markers on it. And that's handy and functional and useful that we mark the beginning of winter and with the solstice, and it ends with the equinox and all that sort of thing. That's functional, it's helpful. But the idea that we've actually captured something there, I remember actually when I was in high school, my girlfriend, it was a beautiful, warm day, even though spring hadn't quite arrived yet. And she came to school with this heavy, heavy coat. And then later, you know, she was saying about how hot it was with the coat and everything. And I said, well, they predicted it was going to be very warm today. And she said, but it's winter, you know. So these things become very real for us. The way that we'll label something, or as if we've really captured something there, as opposed to just looking at the dynamic. I didn't understand any of this when I was in high school, by the way, but I just happen to remember that. But it's kind of a common thing that we might do, because we have the idea, well, this is winter, so I got to wear a winter coat, even though the prediction is it's going to be 70 outside and this sort of thing, which can happen, at least here in Minnesota. We get, you know, weather like that. But anyway, but we'll lock on to our idea about something, winter or spring or the firewood, and ash, and then we talk about it, because we in conceptualizing something like, say, the firewood, we're seeing that as a thing, and it's persisting through time, and right now it's firewood, but at some point it's burning. Well, what is it? Is it firewood, or is it ash? And of course we say it's firewood, but that's because we decided, well, we're not going to use this to build a table or a house or something, you know. So we give it those kinds of labels as well. But we freeze up the world into all these different kinds of things, objects that we can name and label, and we insist that they're persisting through time and all of this. And all the while we're doing that, we're ignoring thus. We're ignoring here, now, as I was talking about before. And we're all of these various things appear as just utterly fluid for us. There's nothing there persisting at all. This is why Nagarjuna says that there is nothing that's impermanent, because there's nothing formed there in the first place to be impermanent. And once we really see things in this way, we can kind of loosen our grip. We can begin to become at ease. We don't tolerate the fact that things appear to be changing, and we're at ease because we realize that this very change, whether it's on the microscopic range or is it in the world at large, the weather or whatever, it is all just fluid and change, and we can't really pin it down, even though we'll use words like it or something of this sort. So Dogen, he says, so when we have firewood, we have something here, we call this firewood, and then he says that this is at the Dharma stage of firewood, which has its own before and after. There's a history to this firewood, how it got to be this way, and that involves everything, really, the rain, the sun, the previous trees or forests that may have grown here even centuries ago, and the sun and the soils and endless stuff like that. But so this is the firewood now, and it has that before. Were it not for countless, innumerable things that we couldn't possibly account for all of it, were that not to have taken place, we don't have this here now. And of course, and it also has its after. And we can imagine, yes, well, this will eventually be ash. But this isn't ash. This is right here. Or if this is spring, this is spring. And spring, winter, they have their own before and after. But what we have now in this moment is just this. We could call that, this is sitting right in the middle of right now, we say fall. But it could be a kind of a winter-like day or a summer-like day, right here in the middle of fall. So then we'll start to ask questions about this. And yet, it is all just fluid and changing consistently. It might have patterns and things, and then as we start to label these things and section them out in various ways, so we can look for certain dates for this to happen or when to plant the roses and whatever. And that's all helpful and useful. But it can fool us into thinking that things actually are just this, and it means, something more than it means. We can learn to just kind of live out of the fluidity of what is taking place here, not ignoring the fact that at any given moment, the firewood or the winter, whatever, has its own before and after. Yeah, we can hold this in mind. But we shouldn't think that there's something called winter or that there's something called firewood. This is where we go wrong. The old Schrodinger's cat kind of thing. The fact that we think that there's a cat and we can put it in a situation where now we're wondering, well, is it alive or dead? It seems to be that we have a live, dead cat, which makes no sense whatsoever. Well, what's the problem? The problem has to do with our conceptualizing. There's no such thing as a cat as such. So when we run into this live deadness, which is always going on, now we can't understand, how do we deal with this cat situation? The same situation that we're in right now. And we think, right now I'm alive, but what does the I even refer to? So there's a totally different way of looking at everything that is happening here. And we don't see it as particularness and meanness and you-ness and separateness and stuff like this. We see it as this great, I don't know, living, dynamic reality where we can't really get a grip on anything. But again, it's useful to label things and, it's up to a point. But our problem is that we start to think that the way we've constructed this is the way it really is. This just simply isn't true. And that becomes obvious if we really learn to recognize the perceptual experience as opposed to just constantly living out of the conceptual. So I don't know if that helped you, Yassine, but...
Yes, it does a lot. And you were saying also it's beyond, before and after, beyond.
What Dogen says, he says like firewood, he says it has its own before and after. It's at the Dharma stage, of firewood. So firewood is, when we speak of firewood, we're talking about it, but it just now in this moment, it's at the Dharma stage, the manifesting stage, the reality stage, something will say firewood. But then we lock onto the idea that there's something called firewood that's persisting. And that's a mistake. Dogen's just trying to point to right here, manifesting as firewood. But this right here has its own before. But those are appearances. We can't get all of those either. But we can understand that, yes, for this firewood, we're calling firewood, to be showing up in this moment, it will have a history. And we can probably tell a lot about that history just by looking at this now. And then we can speculate on what kind of a future we'll have. Well, maybe, turns out, this firewood never ends up getting burned somewhere. It just rots away in the woods somewhere. Somebody forgot to drag it back to camp or something. But again, it's to watch out for that particularness, the catness, you know, or even the thing of me. When we continue to see me as me, here I am, and I'm something, and I'm persisting, now we have all kinds of problems. And things that are even horrifying and frightening. And now in this crazy world right now, a couple weeks before our election here, and who knows, you know, if you really lock solidly into yourself here, this could be a very precarious and frightening kind of thing that you're facing. On the other hand, we can see this all as this dynamic unfolding of life, reality itself, the universe, however you want to put it, but I wouldn't get a grip on anything there other than it's always appearing thus. So I hope
thank
that helps
you,
Yassine.
So thank
you. Yeah, thank
you,
Yassine.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Okay, then we have Mike.
Yes, Steve. I'm not sure if this is the right way to ask this, but what is the best way to wake up to the true nature of reality?
There's no best way.
Oh, okay.
just wake up. If there were a best way, I would have told you long ago. But
okay.
There's endless, and it's not even a way of waking up. It's just there's awakeness, or there's not. So there we are. It isn't like there's, you know, I can tell you to jump through so many hoops or do this first and then do that and, you know, one thing or another. But it just simply doesn't work that way. What we can do, though, what might be helpful is, and this is something I've found out many times, there isn't anything to see in terms of awakeness or in terms of reality, ultimately waking up to it. What we can start to wake up to, and this is what my book is about, you know, The Grand Delusion, we can wake up to delusion. This is what enlightenment is seeing delusion. We can wake up to this. We can see what this is. But is there a best way of going about it? I don't know. But maybe just pay attention. But pay attention, no, if I say pay attention, then you probably think, quite naturally, and I think it would be quite natural to, I'm talking about paying attention to things out there, things that you see, things that maybe you can touch them or hear them or something like that. But most of all, or at least along with all of that, pay attention to your own mind and watch yourself grasping. Watch yourself explaining something to yourself. Always relying on the conceptual construct. Right away we'll start manufacturing one. And then I want to construct it in a way so I can kind of get it. Yeah, so I... You know, and that's what we're doing all the time. And all the while we do that, we're not paying any attention to what's actually unfolding, the perceptual experience, the direct, immediate experience of just this utter fluidity. So that might be the most helpful thing to do is don't look for the thing you're looking for. Look for all the ways that we get caught. And that's most of all, just watch your mind.
Watch your mind when it's leaning.
Yeah, but don't say anything about it. Don't judge it. Don't scold it. Just recognize what's happening. That's all. That's all we have to do. Once we start to see this, we can begin to loosen our grip. And when our grip becomes weak enough, we just wake up. It's very simple in a way. We just make it complicated. I guess we have one more. We've gone over the hour here, so I don't want to go too much. But Dan...
I brought this up before, I'm sure, but in reading The Grand Illusion last night, I ran across the end of a chapter, and it ended with mind and the one mind. And I recall back to the first meeting I ever had with you, I think, directly, was at our Sangha in Duluth downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And you asked a question of the audience there, sitting there, the group, and it was an open meeting. And somebody in the back of the room hollered out, "Mind, And I thought to myself, mind, what kind of an answer is that? But anyway, I think I've asked this before, but where originally is the translation for that word related to the one mind? And where did that come from? Because I always find that problematic.
The one mind?
I understand the difference between my mind, your mind.
Yeah.
The one mind.
Yeah.
Totality, reality, that makes total sense to me. But when I run across mind, it's like, I know, I think Nagarjuna used that term, was translated.
Yeah.
And probably others.
Well, also, have you read Wang Po? Wang Po always speaks of the one mind.
Wang Po, another one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, where did that term actually come from?
Well, I don't know. I would just, I would imagine that it just came from people who finally woke up to what's taking place here, and we realized this is just mind. And again, as I was saying earlier, that mind isn't something constructed out of physical reality. We're so captivated by physical reality that, you know, we'll tend to think this way, perhaps, but the immediate direct experience, we can just see this if we turn our attention to it, is of mind. Seeing, we see the object and we're caught by the object that we're seeing, but seeing, if we're not caught by the object, that there's an assumption now that there's an object out there because I see it, but actually if you pay attention to what's being experienced, is there is just seeing. Same thing with hearing, same thing with touching, same thing with smelling, same thing with thinking or feeling. And if you keep looking at this, and you realize there isn't anyone who sees or thinks or feels, and there isn't anything that's being tasted or heard, or, you know. And all of this that I've just am pointing to now is, this is mind. Hearing, tasting, feeling, thinking, this is all mind. But we always want to put something there. You can read the last chapter of part one, and I kind of get into that a bit, where we always want to put something there within the experience that is having the experience, you know.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with any of that. It's just the term.
Yeah, where it came from. Well, I think since that is the term, I really couldn't tell you. I suppose it did have a, historically it had somebody must have used it perhaps, you know, the first time, I'm sure, but I couldn't begin to tell you that. When was reality first referred to as mind? I couldn't really tell you.
Okay.
If you find out, let me know.
Well, I'm going to have to do some research on my own, I think.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. It's good to see you.
Thanks, you.
All right, that looks like that's it, Steve. So, okay. You know, you in your answer to...
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.